Welcome to Outside the Panels and our final episode of our first mini-series. Once again, I'm joined by always with...
Chad Simons.
And Jack Prewitt, a.k.a. Synesthetic.
First off, we want to wish you guys a very happy holidays, whether it's Kwanzaa, Christmas, or Solstice. We really hope you guys have a great New Year. We forgot that on the North End episode. And this is directly because we are not affiliated with Comic Crusaders or Undercover Capes. We don't always remember Christian holidays, but we understand that people celebrate them. We hope you had a merry one. I mean, I celebrated them as well with my family. It's a good time.
I celebrated both Solstice and Christmas, to be fair.
Yeah, it's
a... And I drank a lot.
Oh, I did some of that, too.
I did not. I was envious of... I drank with you when you were here. Chaz was over the other night, and I had a few beers while I watched Bad Santa, and that was...
Oh, that's a good one.
Pretty enjoyable.
I am a dad now, which you brought up in the last one. So I have my daughter is still an infant, so you have to watch her a lot. So can't really get wasted drunk with a newborn. I mean, you can,
that's commendable.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Some people definitely do.
I mean,
you don't want.
No, it's not really safe for the baby. Like, she's like a little dinosaur, dinosaur sound. She's just like, whenever she's hungry.
If you guys are doing it the natural way, you're... your wife can't drink either, huh?
No, she doesn't drink either way. She hates it. She's like, she was a big partaker of the ganja before she got pregnant, but now she doesn't really like that. But
okay,
never really like drinking.
Okay,
it makes her stomach sick. Yeah,
yeah. Well, I'm feeling that the last couple of days as well. So, yeah.
Yeah,
potentially.
I felt like I got a
white monster in my tummy.
The last too long. If I think about the first time I drank, I was probably like 13, so too many years. The last 22 years, I felt it, and I don't know why I kept drinking. I just kept doing it. I was like, fuck it.
Well, hell yeah. I'm glad we all had great holidays. I know I talked to you guys.
Rye whiskey sounds good, though.
On Christmas and Solstice and whatnot. Anyway, so should we hop in? You want to start us off?
Yeah, Michael. We are talking about my number one book of the year, which is Blue and Green, written by Ram V, with art by Anandar K, John Piercing, handcrafted lettering by Aditya Bidikar, and designed by Tom Mueller. It is a jazz horror story. It's electrifying and consuming. Before we talk about the main story, I kind of want to have Jack go on a tangent about this, because you said this was the best thing you've ever read.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the best graphic novel. It's hard to compare mediums, but it was excellent. It's probably a lot because I relate to it on so many levels, and especially even with what I've been going through lately. I've experienced... death of someone close to me, and it goes a lot into that, and then it goes into music and obsession with music and how your passion can become all-consuming, which is been a huge thing for me in my life, and that is also kind of a metaphor for other things that, and the setting and the art are just magnificent. The writing is wonderful. I love how there's full pages of just poetry practically. You know, it's definitely got like a real mixed medium vibe with the writing style, the art, everything. I don't know. There's just so much to love.
Yeah, so much of the writing is displayed this way, where it's just out in paragraph form and kind of displayed over the beautiful art we're seeing. And the partnership between Anandar K, Aditya, John, and Tom is so beautiful in this. I mean, Anand's a wonderful artist. We saw it in Graffiti's Wall, but my God, this partnership makes his art sing. Like, it's insane how good, beautiful this book is.
I loved Graffiti's Wall. It was amazing. But Blue and Green is on a whole nother level.
Yeah.
It's mind-blowing. Yeah. I just reread it again, and I'm probably going to end up rereading it again
soon. I want to do my Pale Man impression of just some of the great... Okay, so let's get into the introduction. Eric Dieter is a almost middle-aged, I'd say, probably late 30s jazz teacher in, I'm assuming, the South, in New York or Brooklyn. We don't really get city names, but I'm assuming that's Brooklyn. That's what it feels like. And his mother dies, and he goes home for a funeral. And in the middle of the night, after they basically have her wake, he is woken up and confronted by a pale man that's a ghost. And he starts off with the words, "Hello, Eric. Do you play?" Do you suffer for it? And basically, you know, he's almost, I feel the Pale Man is, he's a monster in the story, and he seems to me as almost a representation of music. He says, to touch that shimmering music, do you understand it? And then he touches Eric, which leads Eric to a photo of a man he doesn't know, and he knows both of his mom's friends. So it puts him on this obsessive quest and journey to find out who this man is, and in turn kind of find himself and find the capability of music that he can really perform. And it's this dark journey of letting the obsession of music kind of consume your soul and to kind of become one with music, but lose everything about your humanity to kind of play that perfect tune and to really rise out from being this unhappy teacher to a stellar jazz musician, but what he has to sacrifice on the way. It's such a...
And that's a very real theme.
Yeah, it's... I mean, successful musicians, from the beginning of when they were recorded and fans and everything, every professional musician in the world has had to sacrifice so much of their life just to become that level of musician, and so much they had to lose. I mean, think about anyone with their personal privacy, family members, loved ones, having a stable relationship.
Yeah. I mean, that's not only that lifestyle, but that form of, like, musing is giving away so much of your soul to the world and to other people.
Yeah.
And that's such the open exchange in this, is him basically directly exchanging his soul with the Pale Man to kind of rise above the talent he's had. And the book is so moody. When I first read it, when I got my preview edition, like, I read it in, like, the early morning. I was, like, coming off not feeling too well, and it haunted me. Like, I couldn't get the book out of my head for weeks until I got the physical edition, which I read again. And then read again. I read it 3 times. I should have read it a 4th time, but it's so good. And just the atmosphere he creates. I mean, the art and the story really on the page is just such a beautiful symphony of what they're creating, and it's an achievement.
Even the layouts are, like, super moody and beautiful. Like, there's so much going on behind other panels, almost.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Art everywhere.
Everything continues throughout. Like, their big main draw is always present and then highlighted or accentuated in, like, smaller, tighter panels. It's beautifully put together. And, like you're saying, super moody.
It blew me away the way that they did, like, the they captured the jazz art style and, like, multimedia feel by using, like, design of the pages and how the panels fit together and bleed into each other and everything.
And even the characters, like, besides our main character, I mean, everyone in White Noise have kind of been bringing this up as such a great way of bit players that come in. It feels like you've known them the entire book. As much as Ollie, Chief Wilkins, the guy who used to see him play as a kid that he knows that works as a club and kind of notices talent for the owner, to, I'm trying to find the guy's name, the scummy guy that lets him meet his mom that knows the old club owner, or his mother-in-law.
Oh,
the guy.
Yeah.
I feel like I know that character so well, and he's barely in the book. He's in the book for like 2 pages. I mean,
the guy out to make 40 bucks or whatever.
The guy out to make 40 bucks off of letting Eric go talk to his mother-in-law.
Yeah.
He's real.
Oh, that guy.
The real Morris. Real scummy Morris.
Yeah.
Those people are out there, man.
I'm sure. And there's so much left open in the book. One of the things I love about it is so much is left up to the reader's interpretation, including that of the Pale Man. But
yeah.
I really like that, you know, not too far in the book, he's able to find out at least a little bit about the man. It flashes back to 1967 in New York, and we get our first flashback sequence.
That very same club that Ollie's at.
Very same club. No, it's not. It's a club that just closed.
Oh, that burned down. Right,
yeah, it's a club that the mother-in-law owns that Morris is creepily selling away, where he first learns Dalton Blakely's name. And that's the name of the man in the photograph he sees, Dalton Blakely. And he flashed back to 1967, where he's confronted by these drug dealers, assumed drug dealers, because of the troubles he was in. And basically the art where that Cthulhu horror comes out, the Pale Man turns into this tentacled monster and just wipes out all the drug dealers as he plays his jazz solo. these kind of like striking and beautiful images, while at the same time, Eric is letting the music spread because he's in bed with Vera Carter, his old high school crush, who he kind of has reconciled with because she hears him playing music in the background. And all the music they mention in this and playing jazz music with it really helps the tune. We only been on recently that Bloomgreen's actually a Miles Davis song, which we didn't get to listen to until after. But all the songs mentioned in the book are great to listen to while reading it. The jazz background music really helps the read. I can definitely recommend that.
So I wanna speak on that Vera part there, because it feels like as a character, Eric is very closed off from the world around him. It's not until like later when he's really investigating that he's becoming invested in a lot of people, because he doesn't particularly care for his job, which also makes sense if it's how do you teach somebody that inspiration that they're trying to replicate? You can't. You know what I mean? There's a student at the beginning who asks him, how do I know if I'm any good? Like, I could just be playing the sax and be terrible, but like, nobody's going to tell me. So like, should I keep going? Don't you need genius? And he's like, why? Just play. But it doesn't land on the kid. He thinks to be successful, you need something extra. And then when he goes back home, he sort of avoids Vera because they left on such bad terms. And it's only after the music that they, I don't want to say reconcile, because they don't seem to end up together. He just shares that night of passion and intimacy with her, and then is almost just as closed off as he was before, in that like trapped in his own world almost. So it, yeah, I don't know.
It does it, seem it felt like every time he touches the sax is when an he abuse becomes almost. More open. Yeah, it does.
Like, yeah, like time. he's taking advantage of this opening real fast that this music has allowed him, and then as he's indulging more and more in it, things get sort of worse for him, better for him, but worse for those around him.
It gets better for him musically, and his talents get better, but everything else gets kind of cut off, and he loses everything else.
Yeah, I was going to say, he gets more stuff even, too. I mean, he's playing successful gigs. People are curious about him, even though he's losing time.
It's complicated because while he is achieving some of his lifelong dreams that he hasn't been able to fulfill before due to this bargaining almost that he's doing with this entity, is also tremendously taxing on him and on his soul, like we saw when he was holed up in that abandoned apartment and he just lost track of like weeks working on his new composure.
And at one point he pulls out a tooth.
He pulls that tooth right out.
Which I wanna swing back around on real fast, because you said that there are a lot of different interpretations on the thin white Duke that we meet, the pale man there. Pretty much within the first like 15 pages, we get to see this guy, and then we get to see him unleashed in that flashback, and we get kind of that idea that he's egging Eric on. But when I read it, my take on him was that he was the like personification to Eric of heroin. That there was something about heroin that was, I mean, it's physically taxing. You lose your teeth, right?
Yeah.
When it like absorbs up into there.
Time. You lose weeks. Yeah. Like that, and you lose relationships. You lose your life.
But in a way, there's a long history as well of jazz musicians enjoying heroin, or maybe not enjoying. I assume they enjoy it at first and then become addicted to it. Who knows? But there's a long history of jazz and heroin. And the idea that inspiration is coming from this outside source, this need, you know that it's bad for you, you've seen what it can do, or you're terrified of it, but the reward of being able to go out there and just like belt away on your sax is too tempting. So he kind
of
felt like
a lot of way to that.
A Lovecraftian heroin monster almost.
That they can see, which I would want to point out,
yeah,
is that the gangster could see the pale man. Because he says, who the fuck are you, before he turns into this Lovecraftian monster.
That could have been, well, yeah, that's true. It could have been somebody else, though. You know what I mean?
Could have been even Galton acting different, like, high on heroin.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Like, he sees himself playing, but he's really enacting the sort of violence in defense.
I want to shout out to Tom Mueller, too, and the design he did, because the end of this flashback ends with a scene he clearly put together with real objects and Anand's art, and Anand, John, and Aditya's art. And it's this blood-stained, like, I would say table. It might be a wall, but no, it has to be a table. And then there's this a piece of a saxophone and glasses on it, and it's so unsettling. And it just has a picture of Dalton trying to cover his eyes while these horrible things are happening. But then there's also newspaper clippings. It's just a very, very moody, moody piece, which is kind of the whole book. But there's so many pieces like that that would just hang on my wall.
There's one in particular. I'm just going to send it to y'all right now. That it's right after he encounters the pale man.
And he touches him?
And he, like, shatters. Yeah. When he's handed that photo. And then the next page is, like, him just curled up. It's the image of the record.
This is the time when we talk about the unreliable narrator. Because when he touches him, he goes into a long story about how he fell down the stairs, which I think has to do kind of with the story as well, where he goes into his long story about how he fell down the stairs and his mom wasn't very caring. But then later, at the end of the book, he admits he didn't fall down the stairs. And he made that up, which is kind of another thing here is that you can't trust everything the writer, the storyteller is telling, and most of it is all from his point of view. The only thing we don't see from his point of view is one newspaper clip at the end. But yeah, it's just a record. It has that whole spread out is beautiful, with his face kind of splitting in two or six, and then a record with him just laying next to the desk in the middle of it.
It's such a juxtaposition, too, of it, almost. You know what I mean? Like, to go from that really striking visual to something so subdued. But equally powerful in that the preceding, the breaking apart image has no dialogue or no sound, no effect to give you the idea of something happening, but you see it so viscerally. And then the next being so full of that same feeling, but because of the words that we're reading.
It really
with a
has
really
a
subdued image
to me of like time standing still.
Yeah.
And I really like with the juxtaposition of this styles, I really like how scenes will have like some of the art will look like it's half completed and then the rest of the page will be like total masterpiece.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we do have a lot of time skipping that happens because right after that night we're talking about, right after he touches the photo, plays the music, has his night with Vera, he suddenly gets back to the city, which seems like in an instant. He's leaving Vera's bed and then he's there. But then did he drive his rental car back to the city? There's so much weird time hopping because then he's obviously closer to his job than to his mother's house.
That's kind of, again, why I think there's that drug aspect of lost time.
Yeah.
That you're right in that he's an unreliable narrator. But that there's something else at play that's keeping some of this information from us?
Yeah, because it's just literally the next page. It seems like it'd be immediate, but then later we find out he's far away from where he just was.
Or it could be magic. Could be a monster, man.
Magical monster.
Could all be perception.
The beauty is the fact that Ram has left this up to the readers. Like, that's where I get... That's why I love David Lynch. That's why I love people like that, is that it leaves so much up to interpretation, and you can talk about it for the next decade. Which I'm sure we will. I can't wait to see where this stands in a decade. It's still going to probably be pretty high. I mean, it breaks through all mediums. This would have been a good movie. This would have been a good novel. It's perfect the way it is, but really this story is something special. I'm glad it's getting recognition. It was IGN's number one book of 2020, which
all right.
I think it deserves, definitely. I know that you weren't as hot as me, Chaz, but this thing really just blew me away.
It's coming in at 10 for me.
Yeah, it's still up there, but I just love depressing things, which I couldn't even get through in this very depressing year where you took the right, smarter way of reading more happy-go-getty stuff for all my stuff.
That's true.
Except, like,
but this is the right kind of depressing. You know what I mean? It's an inspirational depressing, right? Because we get to see all sorts of good stuff. I don't know. You know what I mean?
A depressing this year is just relatable.
That's true.
Nothing wrong with
that. I didn't really realize until I got my wife because she doesn't really like movies like that. And then I realized so many of my favorite movies and books are like utterly depressing. I'm always just like, I just love how they kind of observe life, these stories that are depressing, because I can relate to them and kind of how I've observed life.
I find beauty in sadness as well as joy.
I'm not anymore, but for a good portion of my life I was plagued with depression. Like, I've only been like cured of it probably the last 4 years, you know what I mean? And it's just I don't know. It's either a lifestyle change or I just change my mood.
Speaking of the happy and the sad and movies, that brings me to a point that I mentioned to you guys earlier that I'm just going to throw out real quick. On Christmas night, I sat down with my mom and my sisters and we watched the new Pixar movie, Soul. And it's honestly kind of crazy how many parallels it draws to this book. It's almost like it was inspired by it, but there's no way with how close they came out to each other. But anyway, you know, it's got the jazz teacher who wants to achieve his dream of performing live, and it's got a lot about death and passion and obsession. But it's weird because it's like a family movie and it's super happy, and this is a super dark horror story.
That's the Akasha Index, bro. It's like that year when we got Deep Impact and Armageddon. It's just people... The universal consciousness thinks of these same ideas at the same time in different perspectives.
Anyone who enjoyed Soul has to read Blue and Green and vice versa.
If we enjoyed Blue and Green, we got to watch it.
I got to watch Soul now.
Yeah, we got to watch it.
Brighter Twin. Brighter Twin, yeah.
It's Brighter Pete Doctor. I don't know, Pete Doctor is kind of the more emotional of the Pixar directors, though, so I'm sure it's got some emotional.
Oh, it's definitely emotional, and yeah. I was surprised for a family movie, how blatantly it talks about death. Like, the main character's dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Damn. Yeah. That's also a Disney movie. they like to open with death.
Pete Doctor, yeah, though, yeah.
He's dead the whole movie, though.
Creator of Up.
Oh, damn.
And still, the opening of Up, it gets me emotional every time. It's such a...
Oh, man, that one,
it's the first 10 minutes of that movie are brutal. In a way, just being like, that would suck balls. I don't want to grow old and then be alone after my wife dies and then never get to go where we want to go. That's just a true thing that probably happens on a daily basis. That's really sad.
It is really beautiful, though, too.
Oh, yeah, that movie is beautiful because it's kind of about an old man, you know, experiencing his last thing and learning to love this kid, kind of like the child they never got to have, which is...
And there's no love without sorrow.
No, there isn't, because then you get to look at the love in a different way.
There's no inspiration without insanity,
which
I feel like is the message of Blue and Green almost.
I guess that's where we wrap around full circle back into Blue and Green.
Yeah.
So he disappears and he gets to the club that's then was a Korean place and then it's a laundromat now, I believe. No, it was a laundromat and it was Korean takeout, but it once was the jazz club where this Cthulhu-like monster attacked the drug dealers. And we meet our scummy, scummy, scummy son-in-law, Morris, who's getting paid by Eric so he could talk to his mother-in-law, who he says...
His catatonic
mother-in-law, who magically, as soon as she sees the picture of Dalton, kind of comes out of this trance and is alive again because she's remembering, you know, her youth. And it's kind of beautiful how he kind of wakes this lady up with just this picture from her past, and she's able to talk to Eric, which surprises scummy, scummy Morris because he hasn't heard her talk probably in years. And she comes out of this.
It's obviously an incredibly powerful emotional response from her that shocked her awake.
And then she gives Eric the key to the room above the club to see, because there's old stuff in there. And this is where he gets to kind of go through all these old news articles and discover more about this man, Dalton Blakely. And also, once again, run into the Pale Man. And their second meeting is kind of like where the real bargain is met. When he plays Two Wings from Lava Day, and you kind of get to see all these musicians that were playing that song kind of back in the 30s when all this racial issues were really going on, which I think a lot of it kind of hints at that too. The jazz musicians had to go through so much racial issues from the 30s to the 50s to even probably, you know, up to today, they probably still have to deal with racism. That stuff unfortunately doesn't really go away. It's kind of also a monster upon itself as well. And as we all know, the monster in this is a pale man. He's white. And it's kind of the only white character we have in the book besides Morris and John, the owner of the club where Eric's family is from. And just kind of where that scene that's beautiful in this, which I think I might even like more than the other one, is when the pale man kind of becomes huge and stretches out and touches Eric's forehead and basically signs their contract that they're having when he's making him an extraordinary instead of unconventional artist. And his head's kind of just exploding from the background, like he's fully accepting all of it. He's accepting this deal with the devil to basically trade his soul for his musical capability. And then as he says, the rest is all a fever dream, and that's where he basically plays outside the window of this place, draws people from the street to hear his music. And he does this for, what, I'm not at the party. Was it a couple weeks, a couple nights?
Yeah, I feel like it's like it's implied that it's like 2 weeks or something.
Yeah, that he's
like
been up
10
there.
10 days almost. Or,
I think it's yeah. I think it's
no,
2 weeks.
That shit really happens, though, when you're like in that creative obsession. I've definitely like completely lost track of weeks, just like obsessing over creation. And like when you really, it's like a point past when you're in the zone, you know? I don't really know how to explain it.
And you're just fully enveloped by it.
Where you know that you know you were in the zone and you're just trying to keep that same level of energy up because you might get right back in it. You might circle right back around soul style to blue and green, but you're just right outside it. Like if you stop, you're going to lose it all. So you got to just keep going.
The powerful statement, like, do you suffer for it, applies there a lot because it has to do a lot with, like, the emotional response to trauma and how musicians express that deep pain inside of them through their art. And that's, like, an incredibly emotional experience to listen to somebody letting their soul out, especially in jazz.
Definitely, yeah, in any kind of music. And I love the use of spirals while he goes on this journey. We see it in The Staircase a lot. We see it with kind of the saxophone, the monster kind of have spiral indentations because Eric's definitely going down a spiral. But he comes out looking like almost a different man. His hair is unshelved. He's played the best music he's ever played in his life. He's more confident about the music he's creating, which helps out a lot too. He feels more comfortable with this beautiful music he's making. And yeah, that's the scene where... It does lead to not only him finding out, which I do want to bring up now to you guys. Do you think Eric killed the old woman? Or do you think Morris did and ran off with the wife?
I think Morris did it.
Yeah, that was
but
my first
at the
thought.
Same time...
I don't know.
Because we've lost so much and we can't really trust Eric as a narrator, he could have done it in that brief period.
Or the Pale Man, you know, whatever
that
form.
That thought did flicker through my head. But I don't see what motive he would have to do it.
It might have not been motive because the Pale Man's a monster, whether it's heroin.
Drugs.
Or, yeah, whether it's drugs,
yeah.
Whether it's just the form of music. We've seen from scenes before that the Pale Man represents talent, but also he's a monster. So I feel like...
It's a classic sell your soul to the devil.
Yeah. Inspiration.
Yeah, like taken over either by the Pale Man as a spirit, as the basically like the devil of music, or as heroin, you know, just being drugged out. Any of these things kind of could have led to that confrontation. We don't really know, which is, like I said, the Lynchian part of Ram's writing is much of these things are left to the reader's imagination, which I love, which is why I love the next book we're going to talk about in this series with Wickman, is I am a big fan of getting to think about what things mean by myself for hours afterwards.
I think that in this book, I can't confirm it, but... I have a feeling that Ram is expressing a lot of his own experience as a writer, but translating that over to a musician.
I think so as well. I mean, just
it feels personal.
Yeah, I mean, he must have been obsessed just to write a story this good, and you could tell how much he researched jazz and how much it feels well detailed. Like, I can only imagine. I mean, in the back, he talks about the handcrafted lettering by Adichie and how long it took, which he also did with Blue and Green, but just... I mean, these guys all they did so much to make this kind of perfect piece of art come out, which I can only imagine kind of took up all their lives for at least a year. I mean, he was teasing this to me almost a year ago, so I wonder if that was when they were still writing it or it was in the bag and they just couldn't release anything yet, which I feel like it may have already been done, but I feel like it took a good portion of all their lives to create this.
Yeah, so successfully.
I highly recommend listening to... if not the quote-unquote soundtrack to this piece, at least listening to some form of jazz music while reading it. And I swear it's like twice the enjoyment and immersion.
It really, it really heightened my second read. Because the first time I didn't think about it until I was all done. And I thought, oh, I should have put these on. Like as they bring them up, I should throw these songs on.
So Michael, you made a playlist with all of the...
all
the songs?
With all songs mentioned and with all the artists in here. I actually have it on my Spotify.
Is there any way you could post that somewhere so that it would be easier for any listeners who decide to read it to enjoy the soundtrack to the book?
I can post it when we post the episode. I'll post all the music I have on my Spotify and my Twitter. It's mostly just a playlist of Bill Evans, Freddie Hubbard, and Lars Gulen, the people mentioned in the piece. But they're all good, and played more than just the songs mentioned. And the first time I got the book, I was way excited. Ram sent this to me before he sent review copies out and was like, hush, don't, you can't say anything about this till October 20th, which is the same day as my baby shower. And I was like, he sent it to me early in the morning. I don't know if he's still in England. He might be in England or New York. I feel like he might still be in England. But he sent it to me at like 5 a.m. our time, and I was still awake, so I didn't even think about the music. I was just like, yeah, and downloaded it. And
I gotta read it.
I read it in a fury, and then I was just like, oh my God. And it was actually you, Chaz, being like, I gotta play jazz in the background. And then, God, that made my second read. Just listen to all these musicians kind of go crazy on the jazz music that's in the book. It's great, because then when Eric's playing it, I definitely did that with each song, so then I could kind of picture more of the sound he's creating and the fact he's kind of adding his own talent and own riffs on each song to it. Another character which is greatly developed in this, that is only in a little bit, he has basically two scenes, is the detective.
Yeah.
He's great.
He's a terrible detective, but he's a great character. Yeah, he's a great character. He doesn't ask Eric anything. He looks like a fucking complete psychopath. He's like unshoveled. He just ripped his tooth out. And instead he just takes him out to eat and then goes and sees him.
He's a real nice guy.
He's really nice, yeah.
And I'm pretty sure he cracks some pretty zesty whips.
He does. He's definitely really friendly and nice and jokey with Eric and kind of just fascinated by him. And that's a difference in Eric changing, you know what I mean? Eric, at the start of the story, I don't think he would have done as well with this detective. But his kind of new, new transformation from the Pale Man has really kind of let him connect with this detective that isn't asking him why the fuck he looks the way he is and what the fuck he was doing in one room for 2 weeks.
I think that
while playing out into the street for everybody.
I think that the detective comes as a really refreshing relief in the end when it starts getting really dark, is like when he shows up and kind of adds a lighter atmosphere.
Yeah, because he's not your typical detective. You'd usually think, in most sense in these stories, when the detective comes in, he's kind of the antagonist. He's the one that's going to be on to Eric or be investigating him, but he's not. He just goes with the flow, and then...
So he's a friend. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, so far as we know, though, too, Eric hasn't committed a crime.
We really...
Necessarily.
We don't
right?
know,
like,
We
think maybe he did, or he could be doing some things that are...
unsavory.
Maybe illicit instead of illegal, right? Like, there's, some unsavory things. Generally, it's kind of nice that there's a air of innocence with this detective, that he's not immediately like, look at how you dress. Look at, what am I supposed to think?
No,
I'm running
just,
you downtown.
He gets some food and then compliments his music when he plays for him just a little bit. And basically tells him how.
It's like reverse Rambo.
Yeah. It's the reverse Rambo.
It's going to keep you in town and feed you.
And he's also like,
just
well,
put you on the edge.
You're a suspect, but I don't really think it's you. Just want to let you know.
Yeah.
It also...
I wonder if they say that to all their perps.
All the perps.
Or if he's just special.
Maybe.
You say that
I
to all the perps, don't
bit.
You? Yeah.
Might also make interrogation tricky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know I
no
said your music was beautiful, but what did you do to the old woman? A few years ago, La La Land, that movie touched on this, and a few other pieces have done it, kind of the fact that jazz music is dying in America for so long it was prominent. I mean, there's still jazz-obsessed people and vinyl-obsessed people, but so much so that the jazz club, the owner, John, is having to rent it out for pornos to basically pay the rent, which Eric...
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was a zesty...
Eric being in his dazed state just walks right in on a porno being filmed and like doesn't even seem to notice or make any change of attitude and just kind of gets his gig, which is a great scene also, where he doesn't even seem to care or say anything. Not saying he would care, but it's like the other world doesn't even exist to him anymore.
I think, isn't that the same scene that we find out that Ollie's like dead?
No, he didn't die. He just left. He fired him. That is the same scene.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I thought he died, because I was like, man, that sucks. Like, he got one conversation, he pushed him forward on this mystery, and now everybody that's been a part of it almost was dead.
No,
but I guess fired.
He says, Ollie doesn't work here anymore. Things aren't exactly doing great, as you can see. It broke my heart, but I had to let him go. I gotta do what I have to do, you know? I ask myself all the time, why don't I just sell the damn place? The pitfalls of being a romantic, eh? That is John, our club owner, who... Eric knew in high school.
The pitfalls of being a romantic while they shoot porn in the background.
Yeah.
That's. I just love this old damn building.
Just on the subject of jazz dying in America, I do want to comment that I do love the, there's also jazz living on in newer forms, especially like the, like Flying Lotus and his work with like, or and all the other artists on Brainfeeder and record labels like that.
Flying Lotus is incredible. Yeah, definitely.
They bring jazz into hip hop heavily.
I got to see him live when I was living in SF. Yeah, in 2000,
I've always wanted to see him.
2017. He played at Wormhole, dude. He played at Wormhole on a Friday, not a Wednesday, and it was so fucking packed. It was insane. I saw people from Nevada City there. Like people from literally Northern California drove down. We're just waiting in line to see.
Yeah, I know some of the Wormhole guys. I've played Renegades for them out here in Nevada County.
They closed that down, which sucks. Do they even have the Tahoe one anymore?
I don't know. I imagine they would have closed the Tahoe one first before the Bay one.
Before the Oakland one, yeah. You would think.
Yeah, because the Oakland was first and it was bigger.
I think 2019 was the last time that they played anything there, which is, I think, kind of just, besides this terrible pandemic we've all been dealing with, kind of the death of music and theaters. Like, so many things I enjoy
God,
in person.
Oh, my God, it's so devastating.
Yeah.
Especially as someone in the industry.
And it's sort of me that has a daughter, like, live shows and movies I love, and I have to think, I think it was all the time, like, when I'm raising her, will she not even know, but, like, going to the movie theaters or going to a live show, how, I mean, will she, what, well, if we're not smart, it might have to be well into her later years, maybe 18 years, so she's able to experience any of these things we took for granted for so long.
Well, what was particularly devastating, too, is just watching so many of my, like, friends.
Everyone I know
and
in
family, like, lose.
I work production,
like, production
for
companies.
Yeah, I worked 2 straight years in production and every
events that they work at, and
I probably know 3,000 people that don't have a job in California because of this pandemic.
Yeah,
I mean, and all they do is
especially
production,
especially in entertainment. And
Gavin Newsom said that he might not open anything for shows in California until 2022. Which I just think about all my friends in production. That's the only thing they've known how to do
really
most of
sucks,
their life.
But it might be what we have to do for the greater good, you know?
Greater good.
We should probably hop back into the book.
So he gets
I don't
want to
get depressing.
It's okay. It's a real thing. I mean, I feel like even before COVID, these things have been happening. We're kind of like, stuff we took for granted, like music and theaters, have kind of been, you know, it's like the force before COVID, being forced to do everything from your home.
I'm just hoping in a few years when we get things under wrap, or hopefully sooner, but I don't see this ending for at least another year.
I'm saying October.
I'm hoping that we get a big old summer of love once we get this thing under wraps, because everyone's gonna want to go party and hang out with their friends and listen to music and stuff when it's safe to do so.
I've already told my wife that I want to work a few production jobs just so I could take her and my daughter to it and kind of, you know, she doesn't really like huge crowds of people, but you always have the production camp where there's not many people at, you know.
Well, we were talking about going to a festival together when they reopen, right? Which one?
Definitely.
So anyway, let's get back on Blue and Green. We've been on a really long tangent that turned into multiple.
It's okay.
Tangents.
I mean, tangents are good. I think that's what's going to make us survive is our tangents. It's the best part
definitely.
Of podcasting.
I love them. Yeah.
So he gets his gig and he gets to play this club. He's known since his childhood and he's the lead performance. We get the great little picture of grand reopening Friday, August 11th, live performance. Beckers presents Eric Dieter. Doors open at 8:00. And that's the one's really good. You and the night and the music, where then Eric starts out his play there and he has his big moment, his big, you know, as the movies, you know, lead up to a conclusion and like the highest point, this is Eric's highest point. He gets to finally do what all of his dreams have been after, play a sold out club and kind of blow everyone away by his music, including Vera, who's in the audience, who has some news for him. Which is a symbolism, I think, with what's going on with Dalton and him, is that somehow just that one night of passion, as someone that knows how hard it is to actually get pregnant, I guess these things do kind of happen, is that Vera is pregnant with his child. And that relates to what we find out about Dalton in a little bit. But where are you guys at the book at this point?
I really enjoyed that interaction between Vera and Eric, because he'd been dodging her, essentially, for... Like, this is, he goes and gets that gig almost right after talking to that detective, after that 2 week stint of like not talking to anybody. So I thought it was interesting that he's got the confidence to go do all this stuff on stage and then even interact with the police, like we're saying, and then have this conversation. It is pretty wild that that one night of passion, but the fact that earlier in the book it's like overlaid with the flashback of the monstrous entity taking out those gangster guys and burning that club down. They're sort of like overlaid their night of passion with this flashback idea that there could be a little bit of magic to it if there is a monster, right? Something that needs to continue its line.
Well, and I won't get to that to the end when we talk about the end, which we won't give away completely, but I do want to talk about the last line from Eric in the book, which relates to what the title is. But I also, he's changed so much from this transformation is when he first runs into Vera, you know, he's clearly still in love with her. And you know he'd pay attention to her, whereas when she runs into him after the club, basically telling him she's going to bear their child, his talking is so dismissive to her when he's, yeah, replying to her and saying they need to talk. But it's so dismissive from his tone and how he actually doesn't care that they do a great layout where when he's talking, he's blocking the word bubbles. So you can't even see it all to kind of show that what he's saying
it's
doesn't...
not important at all.
Exactly. It doesn't matter at all. That complete change. I mean, finding out you're about to be a dad, I know from experience, is usually a pretty big thing, or at least some emotional change is warranted. But he's just kind of like, eh.
So, yeah, my thoughts on that were I really loved the way... I mean, it's pretty sadistic, but I loved the way that it showed him, like, getting with his dream girl and then... oops, he knocked her up. But also it's like finally being able to break out of his mental shackles from his childhood trauma and finally achieve his dream as a musician. And
the kind of let that go.
Fucked up irony that he can't do both.
Yeah.
He can't be a family man if he's selling his soul to the devil. But he can't have his like life passion fulfilled if he decides to, quote-unquote, do the right thing, probably is what a lot of people would say, you know?
Or even, like, give in to that one obsession, because he was obviously clearly kind of obsessed with her, but he gave in to one and kind of had to let the other one go.
I mean, I might be the bad guy for saying this, but I'm kind of on his side there.
I mean, regardless of what Eric does, I feel like we're definitely with Rams riding on his side the entire journey. I mean, even to the end. So... after the club, he finds out from records that Dalton was his grandfather. And that's why his mother had the photo. And that's the connection between everyone here. Well, I didn't realize the age difference. When I was first reading this, I thought he was going to end up being his father. But no, he's the mother's father. And then we find out he burned down the apartment building he was in. And I love the art in that piece is because you see Dalton pacing with a gun in his room. And in the background, you could see a tentacle of smoke, symbolizing kind of the pale man on his back. The little art things they do throughout this book are incredible. Then you see the monstrous Cthulhu vision too, which is just all of them rising from the floor.
The Lovecraftian squid monster vibe totally took me off guard.
Yeah?
Fucking loved it. When I saw it, I was like, what the fuck? And I couldn't decide if it was awesome or stupid. And then I definitely settled on awesome.
Yeah. And then there's the pale man guiding his hand, which I almost thought he was going to use to kill himself, right?
And he almost looks like a spider holding his arms up. He looks almost like a spider.
Yeah, his coat's opening up almost like he's got four other arms hidden under there or something. But then later, when they talk about what they found in the fire, they show an image of a skull, and the skull kind of almost looks like maybe it has a bullet hole there in it. So perhaps he did after setting the place alight.
Then we get our mysterious table again that's splattered in blood, which kind of has all of this displayed along with the basically birth confirmation of this judge chaining and Jing his mom's name so that it no longer is related to Dalton. And then we get to our final chapter, which kind of leads to Eric confessing he had made up the story about falling down the stairs. And then, actually, no, that's actually, I was wrong. That's when he pulls out his tooth chaz. It's not until that part in the story where he kind of just pulls it out, which I'm sure is kind of a symbolism for the soul and other things of something that is nagging him that he's ripping out. And he's talking about his mother. kind of just the way she loved him and raised him.
And then well, and also didn't always show the love probably appropriately.
Which yeah, I mean, I understand where she's coming from, but she definitely kind of like fucked him up and gave him a shit ton of trauma.
Yeah. And seeing that imposing image of her earlier in the book when they talk about memories.
With the broom?
Eric and his sister.
Yeah.
As you go through the book, you drawing come to understand on the walls it, and stuff. But it's still harsh and unjust, I think.
Yeah.
Early on, I had, like, no sympathy for the mom or her actions.
Later I did.
And then by now, I'm thinking, like, oh, she was trying to save him from this similar obsession that killed her father.
Yeah.
Or from this creature that perhaps is carrying the blood.
All to this final confrontation with Eric and the Pale Man, where it's this confrontation of him and his obsession and him and the Pale Man. And I love these last lines without giving too much away. The Pale Man says, "Come, Eric, there is an extraordinary choice to make yet." And then he says, "I see now flecks of blue in your eyes." They were blue then. And then he says, "My grandfather's eyes were blue." And that's kind of the last thing of the story we hear from our narrative piece, Eric. And then it kind of hints that if this is a monster, it's familial, and the Pale Man might be his great-grandfather or someone related to him, which I think is an interesting take as well.
Oh, definitely. It's in the blood. It's in his DNA. It's in his ancestry.
Yeah, exactly. That there's some white in him as well, which kind of is not brought up earlier, but then him kind of recognizing it in his grandfather. And then I love the use of Van Gogh's art during all these scenes too, which I could definitely see a lot of inspiration from the palette they've kind of created for the book.
Oh, yeah definitely.
I know, as it goes further on, that's what I was going to say.
Also, could be a
especially as he's,
curse.
Yeah,
it's very genetic addiction. So,
actually, that's been disproven.
Is it? Oh well,
in recent studies, but it's a nature versus nurture thing. It's like
that's
most likely,
yes.
You know, because where it comes from in family isn't actually genetic, but it's like a behavioral
being surrounded by
that gets
makes
passed
it,
down.
Yeah.
So like if you're like adopted and your dad was an alcoholic, you know, it's not like you're going to pick that up from him, but.
And I know some people that hate alcohol because their parents are alcoholics. So it's very true.
Yeah.
My dad thinks that everyone in our family is an alcoholic because he is.
That's projection.
Simply not true. Yeah.
I mean, that's what we all do. I try to not do anymore, but definitely I feel like that's what most humans do. I feel like most of me growing up and becoming a good person was stop projecting my shit on other people. So I feel like we all do that to each other. Not on purpose. It's subconscious. But we definitely do.
Yeah. So I definitely relate a lot with the that interpretation and could see it myself when I was reading it, even though it's not like how I necessarily interpret it, like that wasn't the main gist I got from it, but it was like hidden in the background the whole time for me as I read it too.
There's a lot of like language too that like really implies it as he's going through reading his mother's diaries near the end that you're talking about. She mentions that she knew the thing that sat upon Dalton's shoulder, so like even if she didn't see it, she understood its nature. She
so
knew
there wasn't a monster. She knew it was heroin. She didn't want her son to get involved with that scene because he might be led right into it as well.
Yeah. Something along those lines, but
I love that they mentioned that right after we literally see the monster on Dalton's shoulder.
Yeah. All long and toothy.
Yeah. The art, just once again, I mean, everything, the writing and art, such a perfect collaboration here. Most of these are Ram's normal collaborators. The only new people are John and Tom. And I really hope this whole creative team, which I'm sure they will, do something in the future. They have he just posted something the other day. I forget which artist it's from, but he has something coming out, which I don't even know. It's going to be Kickstarter, but it looks really moody and beautiful too. Ram just posted the other day. I'm really excited to see what all these guys do in the future. I know that Aditya just said what I've kind of been saying, that he's taking a break in 2021 and not doing as many projects. So I guess it wasn't just me thinking, Jesus, how does this guy do this? Because it's crazy the amount of work this letterer did this year. It's crazy.
It's wild.
And also
unique, too.
Yeah, everyone's unique and he handcrafts it, which means this guy is fucking writing a lot.
Yeah.
Creating different interpretations for each world, which he just did a book that came out recently, which is another White Noise book, which we'll talk about later once the series is completed, but not getting too much off topic, but they're all one studio, so I'm not going to really get too... I don't think Ram's going to get too upset if we talk about a Dan Waters book real quick, because they're partners and really close friends. But my God, the picture of everything else, the lettering in that, and everything in that book for me fires on all cylinders. Like, I just feel like I'm reading a Charles Dickens horror story, kind of how this is a jazz horror story. That for, like, the whatever it is, 22 pages of that first issue, the collaboration in that project literally transported me to France in the late 1800s. Which kind of how this book transported me to the world of jazz musicians, which I'm glad that Aditya's art is shining through all these projects. I hope, I'm pretty sure he had all these done before he announced that he's going to do less next year. So I can't wait to see the finish of his work with Giga and with Department of Truth, which is another amazing new title. Chaz, that latest issue, not getting too off topic. My God.
Yeah. I just read 3. I got to read 4 today.
Ah, it's good. It's really
yeah,
good.
3 was super good. 3 had
four
like
is my
some
favorite.
Insane layouts.
4 has crazy layouts and it takes on the deep state. And
oh man,
it's crazy.
I really need to pee. I'll be right back.
Like the stuff that's in it, I can't believe that they say. But luckily, James Tynion uses that great storytelling tool to say none of it's real. Is this an idea?
But all of it's real.
Yeah, exactly. Like. Because the kind of detail it goes into about how the deep state works and Barack Obama and Bill Clinton and, like, Pizzagate and all this stuff, I'm just like, holy yeah. shit. And the military-industrial complex, it's crazy. Crazy good.
Yeah, I always think, like, he's got to learn so much about these conspiracies to write about them as effectively as this. And, like, how awful that must be to, like, subject yourself to these rabbit holes. But every now and again, I get curious about one, right? And I don't Google it necessarily, but I look it up. But I would not want to just like, all right, 3 down, time to read 2 more insane ideas about what people think the world really
is.
And
find out what everything they think about it so you can get it, bring up every detail of the
right.
conspiracy. Yeah. I got to say, I mean, he's still kind of fresh. He's only been around about a decade, but I think Department of Truth is the best thing he's ever written. I mean, that's a hands down for me.
Yeah, that's why the number one issue is on my top 15.
Yeah,
because there's so much given and none like revealed. Like we learned everything we need to know without being told everything, but we are kind of. But we're not, I don't know. It was just such a good setup because it's it just really informed the whole. Series, you know?
Yeah, and I
what's real, what's fake.
What's real, what's fake. And I understand now with, you know, my daughter and everything, how it's hard to get caught up, or now I understand why you can't always catch up on stuff, or I can't wait for you to read that, because, may God, the ending of issue 4 is so good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I gotta read that.
Well, speaking of White Noise, did you like the picture of everything else?
I did enjoy the picture of everything else. I thought it was a pretty good blend of, like, a bit of comedy at the beginning with a nice, like, twist into horror near the end.
Yeah, the ending is great.
I really enjoy some good old backstabbing, kind of. You know what I mean? I mean, maybe not backstabbing, but
I like
the fact that we get to see
too.
Those. Yeah,
yeah,
like, we get to see them trying their hardest.
Yeah, the two main characters
you
are
know?
Fucking... They're a scummy couple? Are they lovers? It's kind of hinted at that, but...
I feel like that era of Perry, anybody could be, right?
Yeah.
You know? It's looser. It's funner.
But they're great characters. They're a lot of fun.
Whatever happens.
They're very scummy.
Yeah.
And then they get themselves in a shitty situation by being
And then
scummy.
Watching them, how they get themselves out of that shitty situation yeah. is like, oh, man. And then by the end of the real end of the issue, it's like, holy smokes. Like, did that just happen? Did he really just do that?
They just set the whole city, half
like
of the
his
city on fire? Yeah.
Ouch. Yeah, and not only that, but, like, his own friend, you know what I mean? Like we're talking about now with the obsession, like, that one friend wanting that apprenticeship so bad, sort of leading him to backstab and betray, right?
Yeah, I mean, he didn't burn his best friend, but he burnt a lot of people that were clearly his friends that he was at parties with and kind of just
yeah.
threw them into the fireplace. And I can't wait for that second issue just to see how much he's changed during this lapse of time.
Yeah.
Yeah. To see how much of the painter, who is actually from another story, it's the painter from The Portrait of Dorian Gray, which is great that that's where that character came from, the painter that they break into his studio.
With a nice explanation for the Butcher of Paris at the same time, right?
That's I'm just crazy about that book. Farm and Truth is right under it for this week's reads. I haven't read everything yet. I read Sea of Sorrows, Electric Black Presents, and I reread Dark Interlude last night, which is really good as well. We could Jack and edit some of this out. Did you read Fearscape yet?
No, not yet. It's next after Coffinbound, because I knew I'd have a little bit more time.
We have more time at Fearscape for sure. I just want to talk to you about it, not like being like
Drew. Yeah, just because it's good.
Yeah, it's good. It's real tongue-in-cheek. He goes even crazier in Dark Interlude. Some of the shit he's saying is nuts. And yeah, I think just definitely to readers, and kind of how he definitely has good takes of fans and the kind of ways they behave, which is not appropriate, but does in a very blunt, brutal way of how the writer feels when fans are acting that way. So we've been talking about this book a lot that clearly all of us really loved. I'm glad it touched Jack that way. It was my favorite thing I read all year. It's an amazing book that you should all read, and I really feel like every artist is putting their soul on the page as Eric puts his soul into his music. So that was Blue and Green. It's a great book to end this Ram miniseries with. I can't wait for all of us to touch on Ram's future works in the future and to what he does next, which he has a new project coming out with Anand from Vault, which still hasn't been announced, but it's something they created after Graffiti's Wall, which they're just finishing now. So I can't wait to see if that's a horror tale or a, you know, comedy or coming of youth tale. It's a great thing we've learned about Ram through these episodes is he really can dip into any pool and kind of, even if it's traditional DC characters, and kind of have his own take on it, which is why I love him so much as this new writer that's kind of done these staggering works so early in his career. And I can't wait to see what he has next on his platter. What do you guys, any final thoughts from you?
I loved it.
I don't know what else to say. You want to go first? it's real good. It's like a good jazz song. It's going to be stuck in your mind after you read it for a good bit of days, and you just kind of ruminate for a while. Just soak it all in. But yeah, Ram's killing it. I'm really glad that we opened with a deep dive into some of his bibliography so that we get the full scope of what he's been doing, both independent and sort of for the big two now.
It's a breath of fresh air to see a graphic novel so beautiful and well told, but with such a high concept and philosophical standpoint. It's very intelligent.
Yeah, I agree completely.
Very intelligent piece.
And to stay on the note of how much we love I'm kind of forced to, but they've all now kind of fallen in love with these noise boys. As for our next miniseries, Chaz Pig and Brubaker, which you've brought up before, and we'll also be covering the works of Vault's White Noise books, which will be exciting. We're going to have a lot of fun with all those books that have come out. And it'll be something else we could touch on next year because all the new White Noise titles from Vault are coming out right now. So it'll be good to touch back on all these works, kind of when we could take individual deep dives on all the creators in White Noise. Because definitely in the future, for my picks, I'm going to pick Pac Nadell and
Dan Waters. Yeah.
Dan Waters. But Ryan O'Sullivan will have to he hasn't written as much, so we'll have to do kind of offshoots. We'll do Fearscape, which is going to be our most high concept episode yet, which is a little tease for all of you. And then we'll do Dark Interlude when it's done. So at some point, that'd be a good April Fool's Day joke, which I'll say now. But can't wait to talk about all those with you guys. It's been an exciting project for all of us to do this, and I'm glad you guys are listening, and I can't wait for our next creator, and I can't wait for our journey trying to all grow as hosts. We have Blake joining us full-time, starting with Brubaker, and then we also do have our friend Tara and our friend Joe coming on for the next season, which they'll be adding their
very
own takes on
these
books we're covering. And right after this episode, you guys are going to get another episode quickly, which is going to be a special, and it's going to be Dan Waters' Coffinbound, which is him, Danny, Aditya Bidikar, and a few other creators, which I'm going to admit I have to grab the book to have all their names, which I do apologize right now. I know you guys have contributed as much as everyone else, but we're doing that book with Brian Wickman, the writer of our first story that we've covered, Grit, is decided to come on and talk about Coffinbound with us. So that's really exciting, and you're going to get that real quick after this episode, so that's going to be a fun experience. And I'm obsessed with Coffinbound, and now I can't wait to hear Jack and Chaz's take on it, which I'm really excited to do.
I'm also personally very excited to get to meet Brian Wickman. That's super cool.
Me too. I'm pretty pumped about
getting to meet creators through this adventure of ours.
I'm really grateful that they see that we're laid back enough that they'll come on and talk with us, because I think that's crazy. I mean, we're a pretty fresh show, and luckily through me, because I did PR for Nerds, I've kind of had relationships with these people for a while, and that's good, because I've shown myself to be chill, and they'll be like, I'll go on your show, and I'm like,
well, I was impressed with us by the fact that Brian contacted us directly and asked us. Yeah,
he did. Yeah, I posted what we were covering, and Brian messaged me and said, you have to let me on the Coffin Bound episode. And I went,
I don't know, man. We're pretty booked up. We'll see if we can squeeze you in.
I can't. It's good to hear he has such a love of the book, because I do too. And, good to hear a creator's love of another creator's work is going to be really interesting, because he's obviously crazy about the book. So I can't wait to see a creator nerd out like us and see him be just as much of a fan as we are about a comic. It's going to be cool. We'll probably sneak in some questions about his own work in there at some points. Yeah, we'll get a little bit in there. But as always, thank you for listening. We're grateful for all of you. You can find me on Twitter at PoetAir33. You can find Jack as Sin_Aesthetics with an X at the end. And you can find Chaz at Chaz Simons, correct?
That's correct.
All right. And you can find our podcast at Outside The with a 0. As always, you can find our music on Apple, on Google, on Spotify, and on Amazon. And please, when you're listening, write, review, and subscribe so we can know you guys are enjoying this experience as much as we are enjoying creating it. And I know that Jack wanted to add something special for all of you to wrap up this first season.
Yeah, this is an excerpt from the book that I really enjoyed. It's hard to pick what to read to y'all, 'cause there's so much good material. So I'll just go with this one. It flows like molten rubber, the music yawning through my ears before it falls away into some abyss underneath it all. I can hear something growling, groaning, and slithering. Oily moan of broken form. I can hear a clock, tick-tock, tick-tock.